I'd like to tell you a little story about packaging OBS Studio. And if you're a very close friend of mine, this is not the story where I did some contract work where I was paid in 1 kilo of 100% Colombian and took it round to Popey's house for processing.
Are we allowed to talk about that?
This is an entirely different story. This is a story about running OBS Studio for Ubuntu on NixOS and why this is a pretty fabulous experience.
Right. I don't fully understand what you mean by that, so I expect I'm about to learn quite a lot.
Yes, I've learned quite a lot in the last few months as well. So we'll start the story here. A little background. I used to maintain the Snap of OBS Studio, which is still very popular. Some 70,000 people are still using it, despite the fact it hasn't been updated for over 2 years. I did responsibly step down from that, but nobody stepped up to take over the maintenance of that Snap. But it was a Snap of OBS Studio, including a whole plethora of plugins that made it a very comprehensive tool for doing any kind of live streaming or screen capture. Mm-hmm. And I sort of inherited this from Popey, because Popey did the initial hard work of adding the OBS browser support into the Snap of OBS Studio, which basically made it an extremely usable tool. Long story short, due to the stupid stuff I do in my live streams, the confined nature of the Snap wasn't working for me anymore, so I needed to seek out other options. And I tried a number of different things, and whilst I was still running Ubuntu, I started a project called OBS Studio Portable, which was a entirely built from source version of OBS with all of the plugins, built in clean containers and distributed as a tarball, but it was enabled in what's called OBS portable mode, which means you could have multiple versions of OBS Studio installed and running at the same time, each with their own discrete configuration, which was useful for me because I often needed multiple versions of OBS running.
I have to say, when you said installed, you're using the little bunny ears, because it's not installed as such, is it? It's a tarball you unpack and dump in a folder.
Yes, it's just a folder of all of the things that make up OBS Studio in a directory, and it keeps the configuration directly adjacent to the binary that's in that folder, so you can have multiple versions with different configurations and scenes and all the rest of it.
And does that mean plonking multiple copies of that in different places on your hard drive? And then whichever one you run, it picks up its own config. Right. Okay.
Exactly.
I'm with you so far.
Yep. And it's quite a niche use case. But for example, sometimes I did like tutorials on a live stream of how to configure complex things in OBS Studio. And that meant that I could stream from one copy of OBS and have a separate copy, which was a blank canvas, which I could actually use on stream to do things with. Anyway, I now use NixOS. So some months ago, I embarked on a journey of bringing all of these plugins and what have you to NixOS, which I have done. I have packaged some 24 OBS Studio plugins for NixOS, and they have landed in Nix packages, and I've acquired my Nix packages maintainer badge as a result of that work. But there are some drawbacks with running OBS Studio on NixOS, which means it's not actually ideal for what I want to do at the moment. And it's one of these situations where if you're like a subject matter expert in something, you can then see the flaws in where it's been maintained by somebody who is not, or a group of people who are not. So some of the issues are OBS Studio, for this browser source integration, uses a technology called Ceph, which is, in this case, the Chromium Embedded Framework, which is, in simple terms, a version of the Chromium browser that enables you to use web technologies inside of OBS Studio. But OBS has a very specific ABI requirement for the version of Ceph it supports. Now, in Nix packages, some clever people have patched OBS in order to work with newer versions of Ceph. But just because it compiles doesn't mean that it actually works correctly.
Oopsie.
So a whole bunch of stuff that you need to do just doesn't work, and in fact will cause OBS Studio to segfault. And similarly, the higher quality audio codecs, which are technically linked in the NICS packages, aren't exposed correctly. And there's a bunch of plugins which simply do not work or cause OBS Studio to segfault. I would hasten to add, none of the plugins I've added to NICS packages.
Of course, we wouldn't dare to entertain the thought. No.
So I've been on a streaming hiatus since about May this year.
Is that because the package is broken?
Because I've been trying to get OBS Studio in NICS packages up to where I need it to be to support all of the stuff I do. And I've upheld my end of that, but I've still run into a bunch of incompatibilities. And the other issue is this. There's new plugins coming out for OBS Studio all the time. Just in the last month, there's like 4 or 5 really interesting plugins being released that I'm already using, and I'll get onto that in a moment, that I haven't had time to package in NICS packages yet. And also, the speed of getting my PRs merged in NICS packages has been quite slow. I'm in a rather privileged position that I can speak to colleagues at work who have got commit access to NICS packages and sort of fast track my stuff. But I don't like to do that. This is a bit like what Mark was talking about a couple of episodes ago in Moodle, where there's a whole bunch of people that are NICS packages maintainers, and anyone could do this, but because anyone could do it, nobody does. So it's sort of that weird deadlock that happens.
Reminds me of the patch pilot thing that used to happen in Ubuntu, where you'd nominate someone to do it on a rotor, because otherwise it falls through the cracks. Absolutely. Maybe you need that.
Absolutely. And so NICS packages doesn't have like a traditional maintainership model over like a package or group of packages or like a domain, like you would find in sort of Debian, where you've got things broadly broken up to special interest groups, and then within that particular packages within that special interest group. So enter George Castro, friend of the show, and his project Universal Blue and the ever amazing DistroBox. So what I did is I dusted off the OBS Studio portable project that I have been maintaining for a year or so, which is this build of OBS built against Ubuntu. And I said to George, hey, George, I've got this working inside DistroBox on NixOS. This is pretty great. I've got access to all of the stuff I want.
Wait. You've mentioned a bunch of things here. So you're on NixOS, and then you're running DistroBox on top of NixOS, which is probably a Nix package for DistroBox. Mm-hmm. And inside that is Ubuntu. And inside that is a tarball containing OBS, unpacked, and you just run it in there, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Right.
You have unraveled the inception perfectly.
When we say inside that is Ubuntu, how much Ubuntu is it?
All of Ubuntu.
All of Ubuntu. So it's running an Ubuntu kernel on top of Nix, or is it a container with some Ubuntu packages, or how much is it?
Right. Yes, indeed. So for the uninitiated, DistroBox sits on top of either Docker or Podman. Mm-hmm. So it's an OCI container that's running within DistroBox. So for my initial proof of concept, I had just a regular Ubuntu container that I stood up inside DistroBox. And then I downloaded my tarball of OBS Studio Portable, extracted it, ran my little script, which satisfies all of the dependencies. And then I ran my OBS Studio Portable launcher, and it appeared and it worked and it was all running at full speed. And in fact, you can see me in this conversation we're happening, not you, dear listener, but my co-hosts, by way of OBS Studio Portable running inside NixOS. This composited version of me that you see is all running inside that container right now. So in simple terms, it's a Docker container with OBS Studio inside it, built for Ubuntu, that I can run on OBS. But the real magic is I've got all of the NVIDIA hardware acceleration working, and the AMD hardware acceleration working, and Intel, and all of the other bits.
Does that hardware acceleration get passed through from DistroBox through to the underlying OS?
Yes, it does, yeah.
Huh.
So Universal Blue has another project called, I think it's pronounced Bayesite, which is basically SteamOS in a container. So it doesn't matter what Linux distro you're using, you can use their container of Bayesite and get this comprehensive full SteamOS experience entirely isolated inside this container, which also updates using the traditional sort of container primitives. And what I've been able to do with George and Kyle, who is also instrumental in the Universal Blues project, is do the same for OBS. So they've created inside the UBlue OS GitHub organization a whole bunch of CI that ingests my Ubuntu build and creates this 1.6 gigabyte container, which is Ubuntu plus OBS Studio and all of the gubbins. And I can now run OBS Studio anywhere, and so can you. So it doesn't matter what Linux distribution you're using now. If you're using Debian Stable and you want a current version of OBS Studio, you can access it this way. If you're running Ubuntu 2204 LTS, which doesn't have the required libraries to unlock some of the new features of OBS Studio, you can now run OBS Studio Portable from this container, because that's built against current Ubuntu interim releases with all of the library support for all of the current features. It also runs on immutable distributions such as NixOS and Fedora Silverblue. So it really doesn't matter where you want to run OBS Studio, or SteamOS for that matter, and a whole host of other stuff that Universal Blue provides. You can run these things anywhere, isolated and forever safe.
I feel like this should have been fixed with Flatpak and Snap, but it isn't, clearly.
So I have used the Flatpak of OBS Studio, and that's terrific. And it's the officially endorsed way to get OBS Studio for Linux from the upstream project. But where I struggled is adding support for the 50 or so plugins that I require to that Flatpak is hard. Read impossible. So that fell short for me. And also, these confined technologies don't work so great for how I need to use OBS Studio, because I have all of these integrations executing all sorts of arbitrary things to control lighting and various other peripherals. And DistroBox, although in a container, runs as if it's natively running in your host operating system. It opens up all the access you need to get to everything. So it's a pretty robust solution. So I will have links in the show notes to Universal Blue, Bayesite, because there may be interested people wanting to play with SteamOS in a container, and also my OBS Studio portable projects.
I have been updating snaps for fun and no profit.
And how much fun exactly?
We'll get to that. It turns out I currently have 62 snaps registered to my name in the Snap Store.
Is that all the snaps in the Snap Store now?
Meow. There are over 5,000 snaps in the Snap Store, minus a bunch of test snaps, minus some that don't work, minus a few others. So I have acquired a bunch of snaps basically because I thought, oh, that would be good, I should snap that, and I snapped it. And then I thought, oh, that would be good, I'll snap that. And I've eventually got lots of them. When I left Canonical, I'd kind of been burned out by this, especially as I was maintaining a whole bunch of my own ones, plus some Snapcrafters ones as well, like, you know, OBS and Discord and a whole bunch of others. And so I got a little bit burnt out, and I didn't rage quit. I stepped down gracefully, I think, because I started a post on the forum saying, could I please hand these over to someone? And basically nobody stood up for most of them. I think about half a dozen people took them, but some of them, yeah, there just weren't people interested in maintaining them. And I kind of gave up on them a little bit. Like I say, I was a bit burnt out by the whole thing. But, and so some of them I flipped to being private, and so nobody could install them. And over time, a few people have nudged me and said, hey, could you update this or could you update that? And I've updated a few and then made them public again because nobody else is going to maintain them. And sometimes I've been contacted by upstream developers, either to say, please, could you update that? Or in some cases, please, could you remove it? Because either it doesn't work or it's outdated or, you know, for whatever reason. And obviously I'm going to respect the upstream developer when they say, could you please remove it? So I just make it unlisted and stop it building and remove all reference to it, right? But I had a spare weekend recently where I thought, I'll have a go at attacking some of these and see if I can get them to the point where they work, are up to date, and I can make them public so people can enjoy these applications.
What was your turnaround in attitude and motivation for doing that?
That is a great question. A lack of hobbies. I'm not sure. I think maybe taking some time out from it, because there were so many of them, and having the Snapcrafters ones offloaded back to Canonical or the community meant I didn't have to worry about those. And I was reduced down to a much smaller subset of the ones I was maintaining. So I think, and the fact that I could just pick them off one at a time, I haven't made all of them public. There's a fair number of them that are still broken or outdated, but I thought I'd mention a few of them. And I wanted to mention some of the challenges and a few specific things that made it challenging and were part of the reason why I got burnt out with it. And I'll come to a conclusion at the end. So one of them, Bomb Squad, which I snapped because that was a game that me and my son used to play on the Ouya when that first came out. That's where I first saw that game. And it was such a good sofa multiplayer game that I thought, when there was a desktop version, I thought I'll have to snap it. And so snapped that, but it was broken. So recently I tried to update it and I had some challenges because Bomb Squad packages its own Python like debug mode runtime thing. So you can poke at the system with a Python command line, and none of the versions of Python within the Ubuntu repository were compatible with it. And so it was a bit difficult to juggle getting all the Python libraries running right. And then I had a weird challenge in that the audio stopped working. And then I had a weird problem where the audio wouldn't work the first time you launched the game, but it would work the second time you launched the game. And it was infuriating. If you remove the snap and then reinstall it and then run it, you get no audio. You run it again and it works fine. And from that point onwards, it works fine. I could not find out why that did not work. So I replaced a whole bunch of code. I asked on the forum and I got a solution, which was replace that piece of code with this piece of code and it will work. And it was very much like Cargo Cult copy paste pieces of code from, you know, another thing that works. I don't fully understand why the old one didn't work and this one does work. And that is a story that happens a lot in Snapcraft, I find, is that there's a snippet of a YAML that you see works for someone. And so, right, well, I'll use that. And I don't know if that's just me. I'm pretty sure other people do that as well. Martin, tell me somebody else does that.
Yeah. For the benefit of the listener, I'm nodding along. Definitely. Snapcraft was really born out of Cargo Culting good reference examples, a lot of which Popey and I created when we were at Canonical.
And some of them don't work anymore. Yes. I also found recently a relatively new game. Well, I say new. It's called Classic Cube, and it's actually a whole cloth implementation of Minecraft Classic. And so I snapped that, or I tried snapping it a while ago, and I couldn't get it working. And I started on this back in June, and I gave up.
Is this actually Minecraft re-implemented, or just a way to launch Classic Minecraft?
It's a re-implementation.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's fast and designed to run on low-end hardware as well. And I moved that, I updated it to build on Ubuntu 22.04, so Core 22. And I had to throw away the i386 builds because we don't support that anymore, which is a bit of a shame. And I had to do some real nonsense with the graphics card because it worked on my machine here, which is an NVIDIA card. And you would think that a snap should just work on any machine. Once it works on one machine, it should work on any machine because they're all isolated, right? Well, that's wrong. So it works on my NVIDIA. And perversely, it worked on the proprietary driver, but wouldn't work on an Intel or AMD machine, which was infuriating. And the solution I found in the Ubuntu discourse, not on the Snapcraft forum, there was a document, a thread that was started by one of the Snap developers, one of the maintainers, that was documentation. But it was in the Ubuntu forum, which I found really super weird. Why is it there? Why are they not putting it in the Snapcraft forum or in the documentation? I don't understand. But I found it, and Cargo Cult copy-pasted it into my Snap, and it worked. So now I've got Classic Cube, works. So that's another one that's now public and that works fine. Another one that I've got is called B2, which is a BBC Micro emulator.
Of course it is.
And I was motivated to update that one because I recently wrote a blog post about when I wrote a virus for the BBC Micro many years ago. And so I was motivated to get the emulator running so I could get screenshots. And I updated the snap so that I could take a screenshot for a blog post. And so that snap is now public. That's great. That had similar problems as Classic Cube. It works on some GPUs, but not others. So I copy and pasted the code from Classic Cube to B2. Now it works.
I remember when we were working on snaps way back, that multi-GPU support thing. It's very familiar to me. It's nice to see that the solution these days is a bit more elegant in that Canonical have now created what are called content snaps of the different graphical driver stacks that you can pull in as a sort of a framework that you sit on top of, which once you know that this is the new pattern, makes all of these problems go away.
Yes. But the problem is if you built your snap on Core 18, so Ubuntu 18.04, and then you move it to 20.04, you have to update some libraries and bits and bobs. And then when you update to Core 22, it's not just a bunch of libraries that change, like the version of, I don't know, lib pango or lib whatever changes. There's also entire structural changes to your YAML that make it quite different. And I think what's missing is these migration guides from Core 18 to Core 20 and from Core 20 to Core 22. That's what was missing in this whole process for me anyway. And another one was Session Desktop. Have you ever heard of Session Desktop?
Yes.
No.
It's a crypto nonsense chat client. And it's built upon the code for Signal Desktop. It's called Session Desktop and it's crypto chat stuff. I'm hand waving that away. And I bumped that to Core 20 because it just stopped building one day and I couldn't figure out what it was. And it turns out that the upstream was building one of their components using GitHub Actions, and GitHub had moved their GitHub Actions bots from Ubuntu 18.04 to Ubuntu 20.04.
Oh, yes. I remember that happening.
So one of their components was building now in 20.04 and thus wouldn't work in my 18.04 snap. And so all I did was bump that to Core 20 and then suddenly Session Desktop started working again. So I've got that published in public as well. So there's still a few slightly broken ones. I'm getting there though, and I'm spending a bit of time in the weekends and sometimes in an evening to try and fix these and update them. But the conclusion I've come to is I overcommitted myself. And I have all these snaps that, you know, it's kind of painful to maintain. And I've learned from Martin the joy that is GitHub Actions. And so I want to automate a lot more of this so I don't have to do stuff manually. But what I'd also like to see is when you go to the Ubuntu Summit, Martin, can you bring up the idea of maybe having migration guides and better documentation for Snapcraft? Because stumbling upon documentation in the wrong forum is not the right way for us to be documenting.
Right.
I say us, for them to be documenting the product.
Well, no, we are us now because we're on the outside looking in and we are doing this like any other wannabe publisher of an application in the Snap Store. Where do you find and surface this information? And as you say, scattering the documentation across multiple properties is not ideal.
To be fair, the counter argument is no normal person has 64 snaps to their name. A normal person is a software developer who probably has one or two snaps to their name. And they know the code intimately well. They know when libraries are updated. They know when they have to move to a new stack. And so they can dedicate time to that. And then the flip side to that is Linux is a tiny part of their market. So probably they don't have a huge amount of time to spend on these things. So it is difficult.
Yeah. And I do recognize a lot of what you've highlighted here, because since leaving Canonical, I have created exactly two new snaps, both of which were games, one built with Godot and one built with Pico 8. And I had to unravel this GPU support and how to support multiple GPUs in the modern way of building snaps. And yes, from a past life had assumed knowledge about the different places I need to look in order to achieve that, and also had a hotline to one of the developers that maintains graphic stacks at Canonical still, and was able to ask, you know, pertinent questions and get some one-to-one guidance. But not everyone is fortunate enough to have that kind of access to good information.
Yeah, I'm still going to keep doing it because I do find it fun and it's a technical challenge. And yeah, I do like some of these applications, and I like the fact that they're available. And for some of them, there are hundreds or thousands of people who are actually still have it installed. And it's quite nice that when I publish new versions, I see the versions track upwards, so I can see people are migrating to the new version. So that's a good feeling. And so I'm going to carry on doing it, but I'm probably not going to try and package the whole world like I used to.
Alan, you wrote a blog post not long ago about some old phones, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
That got me thinking about mobile gaming, because my experience of mobile gaming these days is that you install a game on Android and it's either some sort of malware trying to sniff all of the data off your phone, or some sort of pay-to-win micropayment scheme.
Or both.
Or both. And they're generally not that fun. But there were games before this on mobiles, weren't there? There was this thing called J2ME.
Oh my gosh.
Which was a mobile, well, it wasn't specifically for mobile, but it was the embedded version of Java, which before we had smartphones was basically how you got apps on a phone. And so I thought, well, I wonder, I never really played any games on my phone back then. I remember I installed my first Twitter client that I installed back when sort of the way to use Twitter on your phone was via SMS was a J2ME app. So I definitely had phones that did it, but I don't remember ever playing any games. So I went searching for whether you could play J2ME games on a modern phone. And secondly, if there are any decent J2ME games out there. And surprisingly, I found the answer to both was yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So on Android, I was looking in the F-Droid open source app store, and there is an app in there called J2ME Loader, which you basically give it a jar file of a J2ME app, and it launches it and gives you a virtual dumb phone number pad to control it with, and works surprisingly well. You can like give it different, like tweak the screen resolution to, so not all apps expect to run on different resolutions. So some have to, you could give it a specific one, otherwise it gets confused. And I remembered back in the dim and distant recesses of my brain that there were Elder Scrolls mobile games. So I went looking for them and gave them a go.
Where are you finding these antiquities?
Are you sailing the high seas to find these?
There's a site that sort of archives the internet, which is a great place to look for things like this. So I gave these games a go, and they were just absolutely awful.
Oh, that's disappointing. I thought you were going to have some classics.
Bearing in mind, these were made by, you know, people who made the Elder Scrolls, the classic, you know, RPG series. No, not really. A couple of them are kind of Eye of the Beholder style dungeon crawlers, but really awkwardly implemented. And there was another one, which was this sort of isometric version of Oblivion, which was buggy as heck and just really terribly animated and terrible to control in general.
If I ask on behalf of the listener, I'm not asking for myself, obviously, what's Elder Scrolls?
So the Elder Scrolls is an RPG series, basically an open world RPG, single player, well, up until recently, single player RPG series set in a fantasy realm. So each game is sort of set in a region of the realm, and you're an anonymous person who has been released from prison and can either go and do whatever the heck you want or can follow a quest line and find out who you are and so on like that.
And so you find these jar files and you have an emulator runtime, whatever it's called.
Yes.
And can you just like download the jar files straight onto your phone and then just launch them straight into the application? There's no other preparation or conversion or anything technical. No, it's just literally load the jar file and you're done.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, as I say, there's some configuration. So there's some sites which like have an archive of, oh, here's all of the games that were written for this platform or whatever. And some of them have good information about what resolution particular J2ME games were designed to run at. So that's useful in configuring J2ME Loader. But yeah, once I was disappointed with all these Elder Scrolls games, I just sort of started having a look around for what else was available. And did you know that there were two Doom RPG games?
I was not aware of that, no.
Just two. I'm shocked.
They were released shortly after Doom 3 was released for the PC, and they are sort of the old-style graphics of Doom in a turn-based dungeon crawler-style RPG.
Wait, the contemporary time of Doom 3 was J2ME phones?
Yes.
Wow.
Mad, isn't it?
I think we will chalk up episode 14 as the timeline for Mark is old.
Yeah, this is retro gaming for me.
Did you find actually really good playable games? That
I think they are actually really good playable games. I mean, Doom RPG, the first one, is a bit on the cheesy side, very sort of fourth wall breaking, like nudge and a wink from the developer that you're playing a game kind of thing. But at the same time, it's a decent Doom game. You're running around picking up weapons, and the combat is obviously very different because it's turn-based, but there's a decent amount of tactics because the closer you are to an enemy when you fire, the more damage you do, the more likely you are to hit. And so it's worth getting close to them, but then they're more likely to attack you. So you might want to wait in a certain position and draw them to you and things like that. And yeah, plenty of exploration and finding secret rooms, just like in normal Doom. And that's really good. But then Doom 2 RPG, actually, I was kind of blown away to think about that it would run on the kind of devices that it was meant to, because the animation is really smooth and you've got sort of pseudo 3D effects of it, like warping as you look down at the floor. And it's actually mightily impressive for the time, I have to say.
Are they colour?
Oh, yeah.
I've just got like Game Boy graphics in my mind here at the moment.
If you just saw a screenshot of it, you would say, that's Doom 2.
Right.
Java wasn't the era of black and white televisions, Martin.
No, but the phones of that era were not great.
I don't know.
Yeah, but they had colour screens. We're not talking about the Nokia 3310.
You're talking about the 6680 and the 6610, right. That kind of era.
Yeah.
The candy bar ones.
Just slightly better, though. Yeah.
I'll tell you what, though, some nice additions to the Doom universe, I have to say, are the fire extinguisher and the pet dog.
I have no idea what that's about.
So yeah, new weapons you can use. You can now wield a fire extinguisher, and you can capture the demon dogs and walk around with them on a leash.
Brilliant. Have you considered installing any of these on your Steam Deck?
Ha 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 ha. Funny you should mention that. So yes, following our previous discussion about RetroDeck, I installed RetroDeck, and I found there was, in fact, in the ROMs directory, a J2ME folder.
No.
So I thought, excellent. I'll give this a go. So I plonked one of the jars in there and launched it. It came up in the RetroDeck launcher and I selected my game and I got a nice red text on grey screen message saying, J2ME support is in progress. Please try again later.
Oh.
I hear that RetroDeck 0.72 was released just a few days ago. So maybe it'll work now.
Oh my gosh.
Watch this space.